the minister, walking the rows, dropping a match for each along the way, plots exploding into fire. A combustible wedding next, the happy couple exchanging tongues of white flame, smoke bringing their parched faces together, kiss the bride, kiss the groom, kiss the ashes upon the broom. Scalding birth. A lady on a bed of straw, a doctor on his knees, encouraging, push, push, as the hell howl escaped the mother's mouth and the doctor's face caught fast, the inferno erupting from all the way within the woman, the womb, the tin colander every mother nurtures. Doctor, I can't control it, I can't. Oh, smoke would assure the young mother, but look at its face. You set on dying, cripple? Oh, magic moxie, gonna make you disappear. I'll give you 10 seconds head start on those legs. Smoke was relishing. Smoke was alive. Smoke was closing in. Moxie, moxie, moxie moo. I'm so bored without you. At the end of the fields, the terrain changed, leveled, and Smoke saw better the torches and candlelit windows of the town called Harrow's. His hamstrung legs dangled, numb and pained. The horse whined for rest, but Smoke wouldn't give it. There would be no stopping tonight. Tonight Smoke was going to find the famous outlaw James Moxie and torch him. The wood, welcome to Harrow's sign, looked particularly flammable as he passed it.
Moxie, Moxie, Moxie May, where in town might you stay?
Across the border, there were far too many tracks for Smoke to follow. Moxie could be holed up in any shadow, any locked hotel room, any brothel or barroom or bathhouse. The outlaw could be sleeping right here on the side of the trail, and Smoke might miss him. If he wasn't watchful, could be awake, too. Asleep, awake, asleep, awake. Man of magic, why not both? He guided the horse quietly along empty Main Street. No Harrowsers in sight. Moxie, he knew, could be anywhere. But Smoke found him in the graveyard. He sang no songs. He imagined no fire. Hills became valleys, and the valleys grew into fresh hills, and beyond the last of the Harrow's homes, down the slope of a grassy hill, he saw the amateur camp he was looking for. The headstones were well lit by a very small fire, probably made an hour ago. The markers seemed to be able to dance with the flickering of the flames, as if Smoke were approaching a living cemetery, where even the stones might point him out, might cry danger. The big silhouette of the funeral home on another hill stood out black against the graying sky. The crosses, wood posts, stone memorials, and one-room chambers of the mausoleums fanned out beneath it like devotees, all bent at the knees in prayer. Smoke whispered to the horse,
"You make some crazy noise now, and I'll burn you, too."
He focused on the fire, seeing now the two shapes beside it. One was the horse, and the other, yes, the other was James Moxie. He looked smaller than Smoke thought he'd be, but legends had a way of making a man bigger than he really was. The fire, Smoke knew, meant sleep.
"Should have used one of them mausoleums, outlaw."
The flames were reflected in the windows of the funeral home, but no light came from within. The horse's hooves were silent on the grass, and Smoke could read the names on the markers, but he kept his eyes on the outlaw, and the outlaw went out of sight as Smoke descended a small hill. He could hear the fire, could tell it was close to putting itself out. Smoke rode the horse slowly up a last incline and stopped. From where he observed, the headstones might have fallen from the sky, pell-mell, strangely artful in their chaos. Lanterns flickered, framing the graveyard, but the only fire Smoke saw was the one by the sleeping man in the hole in the ground beside him. Smoke looked long into the trees bordering the cemetery, looking for anything that didn't belong. The outlaw didn't move. Smoke mouthed the syllables, "Magic," but did not speak them. The air was cool, the sky was dark, and untethered clouds passed before the moon. Smoke dismounted, the sloshing in his shins quieter than the fire. He limped 4 paces and looked to the pit beside the outlaw. A perfect place to bury a burnt legend. Fingering the loops in his pockets, Smoke studied. In a moment, this quaint scene would be blazing. He admired the outlaw's fire. Moxie had done good work. It reflected in the black of Smoke's eyes, growing bigger, as he limped toward the sleeping outlaw and the grave dug fresh for Carol beside him. Moxie and Smoke. Moxie heard the oil spilling out of Smoke's boot heels, but had no clear idea exactly what was making the sound, or how it worked. He watched the man limp quietly, circling the open grave and sleeping horse. The cripple had his hands in his pockets, and Moxie connected that to whatever was happening at his feet. There was something awful about the way he walked, something that went much deeper than an injury. He'd first seen him standing up on the hill, overlooking the graveyard, and understood by his dismount that this was the man following him. He looked lithe. Moxie had expected a bigger man, and he wore no hat and carried no gun. The cripple had a big horse, much bigger than Moxie's, and the outlaw guessed he'd made stops of his own along the way. He watched him survey the scene, the thin silhouette illuminated by the full moonlight, up on the hill, looking for movement. Looking for someone hiding. Moxie was still. Uneven steps on the soft grass, and Moxie couldn't see him on his descent of the hill. Then the man came into view again, his shape emerging from behind a giant stone, peering, pausing before carrying on, quietly, limping, stiff-legged toward the open grave. The moonlight and stars detailed some of his features, not his face, not yet, but the folds in his shirt, the bulging of his pant legs below the knees, the slope of his shoulders, and the tilt of his hatless head. Moxie watched the man slip his hands in his pockets, and he wondered if the click sound that followed would wake the horse. It didn't. He saw the trigger man change direction, carefully, walking no longer toward the open grave, but around it. Soon he understood the man was describing a circle. The sloshing sound, the oozing of something wet. Moxie couldn't be sure what that was. One revolution complete, the man began another, a second circle within the first, breaking the pattern to connect the 2 circles he'd made. He was good at what he did, Moxie understood. At times he couldn't hear the man moving at all. The second circle finished, the man began a third, an arc that would bring him very close to old girl, sleeping soundly yet. He limped slowly, patient. Something a little bit gray was added to the sky, and something a little bit black was taken away. He'd passed the mare and was at the foot of the grave, when Moxie heard the mare stir and lift its head and look to the limping man. Moxie watched them both. The cripple turned his head to the horse. The horse, docile, made no move, and the trigger man continued, not taking his eyes off the beast. His steps got smaller, but so did the circumference of the circle, and it took him just as long to complete the third as it had the first. On the 4th round, Moxie smelled it. A wind crossed close to the ground of the graveyard and brought to him the inimitable smell of oil. The man, he understood, planned to burn him and his horse. He looked to the shins again, and the picture was almost complete. Whatever had happened to the man's legs, he'd made up for it. Moxie did not move. The cripple limped to the sleeping outlaw. He balanced on 1 boot, raised the other carefully, and let the oil drip onto the legend's shirt and pants. Moxie watched the trigger man limp quietly out of the 4 circles, to the border of pine trees that guarded the graveyard. Moxie heard another soft click as the boot heels closed again. The cripple turned to observe his work. He reached a hand into his pocket and removed a small box. A flame came to life between his fingertips, and Moxie heard him whisper sing. "This is the wear, outlaw, and this is the win. This is how it looks when you get to the end." Then he let the match fall to the oil. Smoke stopped when he heard the mare lift her head. He was near the foot of the open hole, and he turned to see the beast staring at him. The outlaw was sleeping to Smoke's left, and he didn't want the horse to wake him. He held its gaze for a long time before continuing with the fourth circle. What Smoke would like to see was the rickety beast get up and try to run through four rings of fire. The legend was going to burn, and Smoke smiled with some humor. What a thing to wake to. What an end. Smoke limped to the side of the sleeping outlaw. The moonlight gave strange contours to the outlaw's face. The fire by the grave was almost out, but it flickered a brief shadow on the outlaw's chin, and Smoke mistook it for movement. He waited. A wind came, and the fire moved again, and Smoke saw it was shadows after all. The dark face remained still, sleeping. Smoke balanced on one boot and raised the other slowly, his finger still in the loop in his left pocket. The oil flowed in a thin, neat line, and Smoke knew he didn't have much left. It didn't matter. He had enough. What sounded good was removing his shin and pouring the rest down the sleeping man's throat. The oil circles were set, and they were connected now to the outlaw's shirt and pants. Once he caught, where would he go? The outlaw didn't wake. Smoke understood that the myths, the legendary stories, had happened back when James Moxie's mind was much sharper than it was tonight. That glory was got a long time ago. The legend, his clothes in oil, his horse too tired to address a stranger. Truly, in person, there was nothing to him at all. Smoke limped into the shadows of the pine trees that framed the graveyard and turned to look at what he'd made. It was magisterial. Moxie would wake aflame and run stumbling into the grave he slept beside. Smoke thought he might just get himself a shovel and bury the myth himself. He reached into his pocket and took out the small box and brought fire to life off his fingernail. He whisper sang a song. This is the where, outlaw, and this is the when. This is how it looks when you get to the end. He let the match fall. The outlaw sat up long before the first ring caught the second, and there were two more yet to be caught.
Moxie!
The outlaw called, confusing Smoke, calling out his own name. There was excitement in the voice, and more. There was an accent. Vaguely, Smoke recognized the voice, the lilt to the syllables, the clipped syllables that he used.
Now, Moxie! Now!
Smoke heard movement behind him coming from the pines, and he turned to see a man break through the dark. A red shirt and foam-white eyes beneath a tan hat. Smoke stumbled, the fire building behind him, his legs incapable of running. Then the outlaw, the legend, the myth, was upon him. Smoke had time to think.
Everything about this one is true.
Moxie didn't grab a phrase from the book of cliché pleading. Instead, he took Smoke by the blonde hair of his head and pressed a gun to his heart and fired. The horse whinnied as Rinaldo led her away from the spreading fire, and the flames howled toward the lightning sky, but Moxie heard none of that. He let go of the cripple's hair and saw that the trigger man remained standing, balancing, it seemed, on his lower legs, his chin limped to his chest.
We did it, Moxie!
Rinaldo called, rushing to Moxie's side.
It was magic! I fooled him twice!
Moxie watched the blood pour from the trigger man's heart, crimson oil, down his shirt, to his pants, and to the boots and grass at his feet. The cripple looked like a man who had fallen asleep standing up, his hands at his pockets, as though trying to draw. When Moxie turned to face Rinaldo, he looked nothing like the man Rinaldo had caught up to only an hour ago.
How'd you get out of the outhouse?
Moxie asked him, his voice crackling flames. Rinaldo opened his mouth to tell him, then stopped himself.
Same way you did the trick. Magic.
Rinaldo smiled, but Moxie did not.
The worst trick I ever performed,
Moxie said, the flames rising in his animal eyes.
Was breaking a good woman's heart.
He looked at Rinaldo, and Rinaldo could see that the outlaw, his hero, was somewhere far from the graveyard in Harrow's.
Thank you, Rinaldo.
Then Moxie went to Old Girl and mounted.
Do you need me, Moxie? Do you need me to follow? Do you need me to act as your double again?
Stay here, Moxie said.
From town, as if crawling between the trees that bordered the graveyard, in the first scant trace of daylight, Moxie saw the morning of Carol's burial approaching. He rode toward it.
Carol. Carol started doing the thing she'd heard other people had done when faced with the end. She started listing off the things she was grateful for, the things she had loved, the things that meant something good to her during her time living. For that life, she believed now, was as close to its end as it was going to be, and she didn't think she'd find the strength to say thanks once she was buried alive. It had taken a lot out of her to sit up in the coach. From Howltown, Dwight looked something like a corpse himself. The veil between the coma and the real world had lessened even more. Rot's plan for her to experience her death in full. She screamed, silently, inside the coma, when Dwight opened the door. And she cried out when he pushed her so easily back to the coach floor. Whatever Dwight had added to her dress made it impossible to sit up again. The weight, the pressure, too much. Rot had been in and out to see her, to hold her hand, to whisper sickening phrases into her all-hearing ears. Rot was the one thing Carol had ever encountered in the coma that was not distorted by it. Rot came as he was. Carol had no doubt that the monster belonged there. No sheriff in Howltown, no. But perhaps Rot was the closest thing to it. Dwight had fallen asleep in the drive outside the coach. Carol could hear him breathing. And try as she might to sit up again, the added weight was too much. But she found enough of it to give thanks. To Hattie. To Faradero. To John Bowie. To James Moxie, too. This last one was hard for her to reconcile. She'd spent so many years angry at him. To think of him now in any other way was foreign to her. Almost. He'd certainly done enough to frighten Dwight. Perhaps that was enough to say, I forgive you. It was earliest of morning. She could tell by the songs of the insects and frogs, the wind in the trees that never came with quite as much bravado during the day. She'd been listening to the swaying of the trees for so long that she lost track of the unseen winds of Howltown. The ceiling of the coach rippled, but she hadn't been looking at it. Her mind's eye, it seemed, had finally transcended the coma. Carol was doing something now, at the end, that both Hattie and John had wanted so badly for her to do. She was finding peace.
Don't give up yet.
John Bowie's voice. So clear that Carol half expected him to be standing outside the coach, his bare feet in the gravel drive.
You aren't buried yet.
But no word from Hattie. No right words that Carol could come up with that might be something Hattie would say at a moment like this. That's because Hattie was practical, Carol thought, and the meaning of this statement seemed to be the lock that clicked shut on Carol's casket. She gave thanks to the same people she'd already given them to, pausing again on James Moxie, wondering what might have been had he not run off to the trail. Had she not foolishly trusted the monster that was Dwight? Had she...
No more of that.
Her own voice, stronger somehow. She heard movement from up on the bench and knew Rot had returned from whatever errand he'd been on. The fiend was in the coach with her again. She didn't wonder what he would say, didn't wonder what he would do. Instead, she lived her final moments to the beat of a memory of Hattie constructing a box, the sawing and the hammering, the polishing and paint. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see Rot, slumped in the corner of the coach bench, as he actually was. His wide-open, unfocused eyes revealed a depression, a sadness Carol was grateful to have never known. The monster, Carol thought, looks different when nobody's watching. The memory of Hattie at work continued. The vision of James Moxie helping her faded. And the lack of Hattie's words only meant that Mom was still working, of course, in her own Howltown, perhaps unable to bring herself to say, "Don't worry," when those words did not apply. And the sound of Hattie hammering was the sound of Carol's casket closing. As earliest morning became morning in full, as the beast wheezed on the bench above her, as light added details to the inside of the coach, Carol had already accepted that a coach is like a casket, its wheels rolling through the grooves of an individual trail, one for each and everybody, as the legends of their own names rose, then fell, then rose with the terrain again. She closed her eyes. Peace. The end. Then, without deciding to keep fighting, she opened her eyes again and looked to the beast wheezing on the bench. His indeterminate face did not obscure his eyes, and Carol said, without parting her lips,
"I am not you. You are sadness. You are the end of things. You are rot."
Then her heart beat, not one beat per minute, but two.
"I am not."
And the terrible thing trained his eyes on her, detecting the second beat, aware of the fight in the woman on the floor of the coach. And in his eyes, Carol saw concern, worry. Carol saw fear. Burial. Already concerned with the gravedigger's complaints of a prowler, Manders, wanting both the Carol Evers and Winifred Jones funerals to be without blemish, woke at daylight and walked the grounds close to the home. He traveled the main floor quietly, then took the stone steps to the basement, where Norm dressed the bodies. All was quiet, and all was as it ought to be. There had been no break-ins, no defamation. As he took the steps back up to the foyer, his shoes sounded crisp against the stone. Then they echoed off the parlor's shining floor. He exited under the recently painted white trim of the front door frame and walked quietly past the plot directory to the graveyard itself. Before he came close enough to tell what it was, he knew the prowler had come the night before after all. Something was on the ground surrounding Carol Evers's grave. It was a big black something that at first looked like tossed garbage, but was soon unmistakable. Manders passed under the wood arch proclaiming official entrance to the cemetery. It was a burn, was what it was. The grass was charred to ash, and the exposed dirt was hard under his black shoes. Whoever the prowler was, Manders noted a purposeful design. Four black circles surrounded the plot, connected by a single black path. He knelt to the grass and pinched some of the soot between his fingertips, letting the ash fall and wiping the morning dew on the hem of his pants. He smelled oil, burnt oil, and he wondered what kind of man thought it prudent to waste oil on something like this. A cult, he thought, rising. Manders didn't like this at all. A cult meant more than one member, and a cult meant rituals that might come again, annually, monthly, daily. Who knew? This could become a serious problem. Nearby, he spied the remains of a small fire, and he pieced together the scene from the night before. Worshipping the grave, he thought, wiping his hands together. Who knows what they may have sacrificed? He walked to the grave's edge and nervously peered within, but saw it was as clean and empty as Lucas and Hank left it. And that was nice, the sort of thing he needed to see. The diggers would arrive shortly, and Manders would see to it they made the grounds as presentable as possible for the morning ceremonies. It was a small relief, finding the grave empty. The director turned and looked across the graveyard to where Winifred Jones would be lowered. He detected no foul play, no black oil circles, and felt hopeful that what he'd found was the only damage done. He left the unsettling scene and passed back beneath the wood arch and up the grassy hill. In his office, he made preparations for Carol Evers's ceremony and looked out the window consistently, hoping the diggers might pick today to show a bit earlier than normal, knowing it was a big day. The lowering of two prominent harrowsers before noon. Now, Manders thought nervously, on top of their usual duties, they had a mess to clean too. Opal arrived before the diggers did, and Manders was surprised to see him. He left the office and met the lawman on the circle drive at the foot of the funeral home steps. Opal was still upon his horse.
"Morning, Manders."
"We had a prowler last night."
Opal raised an eyebrow.
"How's that?"
"Somebody burned circles in the grass surrounding Carol Evers's grave."
"You see, Manders, that makes me suspicious all over again."
"Were you not any more?"
"I was paid a visit by the one and only Dr. Alexander Wolfe."
"Really?"
"He corroborated Evers' story."
"A story, Sheriff?"
"He gave the same reasons for Carol's passing as what he'd stated in the letter you read."
"Well," Manders said, "that's at least some good news."
"Turns out he's more of a fruit doctor than an imaginary one."
"You mean a spiritualist?"
"That I do."
Opal looked toward the cemetery. Even standing among the white lilies framing the home's front walk, he could make out the desecration in the grass.
"Take a look at the body when she comes in," he said, without turning to Manders. "I'm not asking you to examine her, but give her a look. Anything jump out at you, let me know."
Opal tipped his hat and turned the horse. Manders climbed the steps and entered the house. The sheriff rode under the cemetery arch and stopped the horse a few feet before the vandalism. Young sunlight against his back cast his shadow across the hole in the earth. He dismounted and studied the circles for a long time. He didn't like it at all. None of it. Didn't like the way it made him feel. The images of Farrah Darrow with the unopened whiskey, Dwight Evers in the shadows of the willow trees on the trail, and Alexander Wolfe in the station were all superimposed, ghost-like, over the fresh black rectangle in the grass. He hoped to hell's heaven a traveler had done this, a passer-through. It wasn't the first time someone had vandalized Harrow's one graveyard, but it was, perhaps, the most significant. Opal didn't like the circles. Didn't like that they framed Carol Evers's grave. On his horse again, Opal headed for the graveyard arch. He would go to Cole's house. He'd ask the deputy if anybody, strange or otherwise, had ridden into town last night. He heard a shuffling in the trees. Opal stopped the horse and squinted into the shadows. Whoever it was, he was doing a poor job of hiding himself. Opal drew his gun and fired it into the foliage left of the figure. He heard a shriek.
"Come on out, then,"
Opal said. Without much hesitation, a small, soot-covered man emerged from the shadows. Opal gestured, "Come here," with his gun.
"I'm not the bad man,"
Rinaldo said, raising his arms, as if to show the sheriff there was nothing up his sleeve.
"I fooled the bad man twice."
"Did you now? Why don't you come a few feet closer and tell me the story?"
Rinaldo did as he was told. Opal noted the genuine smile on the suspect's face.
"I fooled him once with the outhouse, and again as a double. Have you read Doberman's book on doubles? I have."
"Uh-huh."
Opal removed the cuffs from his belt loop.
"Liliana tells me I'm not good at magic, and maybe she's right, but today I was."
"Magic, huh? What's a double?"
Opal gestured for Rinaldo to come closer yet.
"It's how you make a man disappear and then reappear somewhere else. Unless you know real magic, you use a double."
"I see. And so who did you double for?"
Rinaldo was beside the sheriff's horse now.
"The great James Moxie."
Opal held the suspect's eyes for the duration of 5 breaths.
"You helped James Moxie disappear, huh?"
"Yes."
"Then reappear, too."
"Yes."
"Uh-huh. And where did he disappear from, and where did he reappear to?"
Rinaldo looked over his shoulder to the rooftops of Harrow's. Opal looked to town, too, then back at Rinaldo.
"James Moxie is here, in Harrow's?"
"That's right. And I helped him."
"Uh-huh. Well, while we're on the subject of magic, how good are you at getting out of handcuffs?"
Farrah woke beside Clyde and quietly slipped out of bed. Despite the fright she'd had under the bed, the fact that Mr. Evers had been inside their home, she did not think to wake her husband. Just then, she needed to grieve alone. Carol's burial was at hand. As she quietly dressed in the hall, she found herself hoping Sheriff Opal had found something wrong with Mr. Evers. It was a terrible thing to long for. She decided she'd visit the sheriff after paying her respects. She'd tell Opal of the shoes she saw while under the bed, and the voice she knew very well, the one that whispered her name. And if Opal wanted to dig Carol back up at that point, so be it. As she pulled on her boots, she considered moving somewhere like Griggsville. A town where the people were young, the work was plenty, and she could grow up without the ghost of Carol's body asleep in every cellar she entered. Clyde's insistence that time was grief's only cure sounded like pig shit to her last night and horse shit this morning. Griggsville. Distance. These words felt like an all-new kind of truth. Words she could live by. Standing before the mirror, she saw she did not look well. The pain of losing Carol was evident in every feature. She looked at her lips and imagined them talking to Opal yesterday. She'd visit him again today, right after she paid her respects. And after seeing the sheriff, she'd ask Clyde if he wanted to move to Griggsville. She was a woman who cherished good feelings, and for her, there were none of those left in Harrow's. Dressed and washed, she looked into the bedroom again and saw Clyde in the same position she'd left him. She silently thanked him for trying and left quietly out the front door. Dwight left Carol's body in the coach all night for two reasons. First, he hoped the cold air might further the appearance of death. Second, the phantom, the friend, that woke him yesterday morning was right when it told him to hide the body. Waking up on the gravel drive, the morning of Carol's burial finally upon him, he checked the coach, found Carol still at rest, and thought of Alexander Wolfe. The fictitious doctor had somehow visited Sheriff Opal last night. Dwight tried not to let this impossibility crack him, but it was hard work. It was one thing to want so badly for everything to go right, but there was certainly a right way of things going right. Wolfe's visit was perhaps too right. Yet he believed nothing birthed by his fissured imagination could sour the incredible sense of coming relief, the arms of happiness that would surely envelop him when his wife's casket was finally lowered into the earth. He'd fallen asleep to thoughts and images like these, feelings he hadn't known in a long time, freedom from Carol. But there was still the horrifying reality of the inevitable transference, the handing off of Carol's body at the funeral home, the one moment in which Carol must be out of his control when Manders and his staff would have her body to themselves. Sleep still fading from his mind, Dwight cursed the unfairness of life. Even a man with a righteous, foolproof plan had to worry. Everything accounted for, everybody fooled, all holes filled, he still had to worry. It wasn't right. He looked once across the large front lawn before examining Carol closer. She looked good. She certainly looked dead. He touched her arm and then her neck and thought, yes, the cold night air had done its job. Then he turned back to the house and, what if she woke right now, entered the house and walked upstairs? In the master bedroom, he put the final touches on the look he ought to have for the burial. There wasn't much to do. He had slept outside. But it was a look he'd considered many times, even named, the numb widower. Using Carol's vanity, he purposefully ruffled the appearance of the numb widower even more. How terribly sad, he thought, mimicking the voices of the townspeople. Evers is so distraught, he forgot to comb his hair. Dwight had explicitly asked that there be nobody at the funeral, but you couldn't be sure with a woman like Carol. People liked her so very much. And still, there was Manders to see, possibly Opal, and certainly those he might encounter soon after Carol was buried. Buried. The words sounded sweet, like dessert. He splashed water under his eyes and tugged on the flesh of the numb widower's face. He rehearsed a handful of expressions in the glass. This was the numb widower recalling a private moment with his wife, A half-blind, distant gaze, his chin to his neck, his lips fish-like and unsmiling. This was the numb widower recalling a favorite joke of hers, something clumsy she had done, perhaps. And this was what he looked like accepting the severity of the ceremony, her departure. A humorless granite stare into the future, years to be spent alone, without the love he'd so cherished. Satisfied, Dwight rose and split the drapes covering the nearest window. He could see the coach below in the drive.
"Do not wake," he said. "Please, Carol, do not wake."
Then, after forcing himself to inhale and exhale steadily for a minute, he left the master bedroom, the second story, and the house. On the ride to the Mander's funeral home, Dwight wondered if the Black Providence watching over him might continue this very important mourning. The shroud who woke him, the imaginary doctor visiting the very real sheriff. Would this ghastly fortune persist? Might not this helper be there when the apex came? The moment of deliverance, the handing off of her body? Hide your lady. Indeed. But what advice would the shadowy savior give him when he couldn't hide her? When he had to carry her out under the bright sun for all to see? If smoke hadn't stopped Moxie, if Moxie were somehow alive in Harrow's, now, Dwight would need all the black magic he could get. He cracked the reins. These thoughts persisted, yet none of them were quite powerful enough to crack the ecstasy of the momentous occasion ahead.
"Do not wake!"
he called over the thunder of the hooves.
"My dearest, my love, today is your burial!"
Carol did not wake, but her heart beat three times a minute. And the wheezing creature slumped on the bench looked out the coach window, not as if observing the passing landscape, but as though able to see much farther, to all of Harrow's itself, even into the detectable hearts of all those in town. After disposing of the man who had been tracking him, Moxie rode under the cemetery arch and stood at the head of the funeral home drive. He'd wait here for Carol's casket. When it was brought up the street, he would remove his gun, introduce himself, and tell them to open the box. If they didn't, he would shoot them. But long before anything like that happened, a woman called his name. From the far side of the graveyard, beyond the view of the funeral home windows, a woman's voice traveled the wind like dust, like flakes of skin, like ash. Rinaldo, hiding in the woods, did not indicate that he heard it. Moxie, his eyes still reflecting the dying flames, as if they'd reached a new zenith, took his gun from his holster and turned to where the voice came from. His face was black with soot.
"James!"
a woman called from far across the markers.
"Come here."
Moxie led the horse toward the sound, back under the arch.
"Moxie!"
Rinaldo called.
"Where are you going?" "James, come. Come here, James."
The tombstones obstructed his view, but Moxie thought he saw her waving, the outline of a woman, black hair tousled by no wind. The gesture was familiar, the voice too, and Moxie held his gun waist high. Molly.
"Come here, James. Come here. Meet my friend, Carol."
"Molly?" he said, the craziness in his face softening.
"Moxie?"
Rinaldo stepped toward his hero, and, without looking, Moxie trained his gun on him. Rinaldo stopped.
"I'll wait here,"
he said.
"I'll guard the grave."
Moxie rolled old girl to an old stone whose letters had evaporated over time.
"Come here, James. Meet my friend."
The woman's hair and forehead were visible above a wide marker, but she vanished quickly. Moxie followed. She showed and hid behind other stones. Moxie followed. He caught her behind a mausoleum.
"Come here. I want to introduce you to my friend."
It was Molly. She was undressed. But it was not Molly as she looked the day he met her, the day she introduced him to Carol in a tavern. It was Molly as she looked now, dead for so many years. Moxie gripped the reins. Her black hair looked like string woven into the wrinkles of her scalp. Her face, it seemed, had shrunk with death, her eyes far from her ears. She spoke his name, and he could smell the individual letters. As she smiled, the bones of her face tore the garlic-thin skin that remained.
Molly?
She gestured for him to follow her. Something moved within her sagging gray breasts. Moxie followed.
Molly, are you taking me to Carol?
The guilt, the memory, the moment he met Carol. Molly turned, and for a breath, Moxie saw that both her eyes were in one socket, the other empty and dark.
I've always brought you to Carol.
Like Moxie had acted childish for asking. They passed the last of the graves, and Molly continued ahead, into the pines that framed the grounds, then into the sunless forest that stretched from the grassy grounds to the homes of Harrows.
Molly, Moxie said, blinded by remorse. I don't want to meet her, your friend. I'll do her wrong. I'll hurt her.
Young laughter from inside a tavern erupted, and the first real sign of the sun arrived.
Come, James. You're going to fall in love with her.
Moxie led old girl around solid stumps and fallen logs. Molly led them both. She's taking you to Carol, he thought. Carol's the reason you ride again. Go to her. Follow Molly. Go to Carol and wake her. Tell her you're ready to help her now. The space between the trees grew smaller. An old girl had trouble getting through. Molly blurred ahead, visible, then not. Moxie called to her.
Wait!
A crisped shoulder, the bones of her spine, partial images shown, then taken away. Moxie could still smell her, but he could see her no more. His name echoed off the bark of a thousand trees, the sweet sing-song voice of the dead woman, asking him to follow. Come on, come meet my friend. Love awaits thee. As he cried out, sweat coursed down the sides of his open mouth, rivulets in the soot. The sun was rising. The burial was soon, so soon. Was Molly taking him to Carol's box? She must be. She must. But as Moxie guided old girl between a pair of maple trees as thick as the columns of the Mackatoon courthouse, as he entered a blossom grove, he saw there was no box in the clearing at the foot of the black cherry trees. It was Carol herself instead. She looked as she looked now, 20 years since last he saw her. Since the day he carried the owl fly in a jar away from her house. Her bare feet crunched pine needles on the forest floor. She looked so intelligent, so strong, so totally alive.
Carol, Moxie said, riding slowly toward her. Carol, you're awake.
Carol smiled. Her face, her expression, the strength in her eyes, the independence in her posture. It was everything Moxie would have hoped she'd become. He smiled, too, as he dismounted. Old girl neighed and Moxie patted her on the side, as though telling her, "We made it. We've reached the end." Moxie stepped toward Carol. Then Carol collapsed. When Manders showed him the Belafonte, Dwight just about screamed. He thought something had gone wrong, or was about to go wrong, or that Manders was feigning niceties, but 10 lawmen were about to come out from the back room and shoot him without asking why.
Incredible,
Dwight said, trembling, gaping at the ornate box displayed in the funeral home's foyer.
Any idea who it's from?
Manders asked. He noted the thin line of a scratch on Dwight's cheek. Dwight turned to him, wide-eyed, then back to the Belafonte. He didn't know who sent it, and the existence of the thing scared him. Deeply.
Well,
Dwight said,
it's a beautiful piece of work. It's...
Don't let them use it, Dwight thought. Lucas and Hank walked in carrying a stretcher between them. Norman entered, too. Manders politely explained to Dwight that it was time to transfer the lady from his coach to the casket. Dwight agreed because he was afraid to say no. He followed them outside. As the diggers opened the coach door, Dwight held his breath. He had removed the rocks and earth from her dress only minutes ago, just prior to pulling into the funeral home. What had weighed her down, what had given Dwight some peace of mind, was now scattered just beyond the evergreens that framed the head of the drive. Without the weight, could Carol rise again? But Carol was on her back. Thank the sky, Carol was on her back. The diggers lifted her out of the coach, and Dwight saw some of the dirt from the trail fall from her shoulders. Norman watched from the top of the funeral home steps. This would be a bad time, Carol, Dwight thought. Please, for me. Manders was explaining more about the casket, its uniqueness, its beauty, its weight. The diggers were discussing the best way to move her. Manders said he'd never seen a Belafonte exactly like it. The diggers said it was going to take 8 men or 4 horses. Manders said everything was escalating too fast for Dwight. Fresh sunlight painted the half-circle drive a bright orange. So many details. The dirt in the wrinkles of the knuckles of the digger's fingers. A smudge at the bottom of the right lens of Manders' glasses. Each pebble of the drive. Every blade of grass. The rise and fall of Carol's chest.
Manders!
Dwight yelled, reaching for the director.
What is it?
Did she look dead? Or did she look like she was sleeping, like she could easily open her eyes and say, him? Dwight searched his mind, frantic for something to say.
Is the casket, is it good enough?
It's a casket worthy of a queen, Manders said, his final words on the Belafonte. Dwight needed to sit down. He wanted to curl up on the stone steps. He wanted to leap up into the driver's box and ride until the legs of the steeds turned to dust. This was the apex, the unfairness of life, the part of his plan he couldn't control. The final pass before Carol would be forever underground, beyond the reach of suspicion, beyond the guns of the lawmen. Beyond the guns of the outlaws and triggermen, too.
Look here at this lid, Mr. Evers.
Hank the gravedigger might have been trying to distract Dwight, to ease the horror of seeing his wife in such a way.
It's solid Sabile wood, the strongest in any forest on earth. It'd take a small explosion to pry it open again.
Dwight faced the digger.
What? What did you say?
Hank repeated himself. Dwight smiled as a wave of calm carried him towards something more peaceful. Yes, of course. The casket had been a gift.
You can see for yourself, Hank said. No dirt is going to scratch this lid.
A gift. If you don't mind, Dwight said, hiding his growing confidence, I'd just as soon get her safely inside. I'm not a man of prolonged emotion, beleaguered as I am.
Go on inside, Manders said kindly. Go into the office, and Hank will bring you a glass of water. Let us take care of moving her for you.
Dwight adopted one of the many faces he'd rehearsed.
That'd be nice, he said. Water.
Lucas,
Manders said, bring a shot of whiskey for the gentleman, too. The diggers walked Dwight inside. In that moment he felt himself free-falling, a man whose entire future lay in the slippery hands of other men. But he did not mind. Dwight willingly fell. The belief he now held of who had sent the casket bolstered his sense of justice. He had numbers, somebody on his side. It'd take a small explosion to pry it open again. The shape-shifting stranger was helping him. Again. In that moment, madly, Dwight didn't even care if they caught him. In the office, Hank pulled out a chair for him, and Lucas came in with the whiskey. Hank brought him water. Dwight sat and smiled, feeling himself on freedom's front porch, and drank the alcohol from the small glass.
Thank you, he said.
Outside the office, in the parlor, Manders and Norman lifted Carol carefully from the stretcher and set her within the Belafonte. She was as radiant as the box. The director leaned forward and studied her closely. Not only was there no sign of foul play, but Carol looked cleaner than anybody who'd ever been carried through the front doors of the Manders funeral home. He looked once to Norman and saw awe in the makeup man's face. They did not speak, but both might have said she looked to be living. Without considering how silly it might appear, Manders removed a small hand mirror from his pocket and, checking the parlor door once, placed it just below her nose, keeping it there a full 20 seconds before bringing it to the blooming daylight coming through the open front doors. There was no mark, no fog, and Manders nodded, assured that lifeless lungs meant Mrs. Carol Evers was indeed deserving of a burial. Manders closed the lid and felt great relief. He had nothing foul to report to the sheriff. He entered the office. "Mr. Evers?" Manders spoke as gently as he would to a child who had lost both parents to consumption. "We can begin." Moxie carried her body through the forest. He told her not to worry. He could feel her heart beating. She was alive, he told her. Alive. Soon he could see the town through the trees. The rooftops and chimneys were welcome sights. People lived there. Carol lived, too. He walked faster, the mare a memory left behind, untethered in the woods. When he exited the forest, he felt like he'd broken through it, an unseen barrier, as if he and Carol had taken major steps toward something better, toward reconciliation, toward forgiveness. Stumbling upon a dirt road, homes on either side of him, Moxie's boots and breathing were the only sounds. Faces appeared in the windows, but nobody stepped outside to help him. He was, of course, just another dangerous man from the trail, a man certainly to be avoided, with his ashen face, his shining eyes, and the way he walked like he was carrying something, or thought he was carrying something, though his arms were clearly empty. Ahead, Moxie saw Silas Hite in the open door of what looked like a stable. It wasn't Silas as he looked behind bars in Albertsport, not how he looked when Moxie once woke him, carrying Carol, years ago, but as he looked now, after so many years of rotting.
"Silas!" Moxie called. "She just fell. I need to get her to a doctor."
The sun pooled dull in the indentations in Silas's face. His teeth looked made of corn.
"Silas?"
White hair clung to Silas's misshapen head, and when he spoke, his voice was not sweet like Molly's.
"I know a doctor, James. An excellent man of medicine."
The thin texture of Silas's hair sparked detailed memories for Moxie. Of Jefferson's home, of the jail cell in Albertsport, of Aberstown. But these memories were not connected to anything solid in his mind, only pictures with no frames.
"Where is he, Silas?"
Silas smiled, and when his lips parted, Moxie took a step back. Something foul escaped his throat, something not all laugh and not all language either. He pointed farther up the road, toward town.
"A doctor, you say?" Moxie asked. "Will he be there?"
Silas nodded. The Adam's apple sank lower, too low, in his throat.
"Do you like how she walks?"
Silas suddenly asked. Moxie, already walking toward Main Street, responded without looking back at him.
"She's fallen, Silas. Thank you for... Does she smell like the lamb's wool to you?"
Moxie could smell it again, the compost of rot from Silas's body, as if Silas slept in the morgue. The smell of Molly. The smell of Silas, and now, something else. Moxie looked down at Carol and shook his head no.
"You are alive," he said.
By the continued light in Howelltown, a light that began with a flickering candle in the storeroom of her home, a light no doubt lit by a monster that wanted her to see in full the events of her premature death, Carol saw a horribly distorted version of Robert Manders remove a mirror from his pocket and place it under her nose. The mirror, too, was distorted, and the woman she saw reflected in it was screaming, "Help! I am not dead! I am not dead!" And beyond her own pleading face, reflected, too, she saw the very monster floating, wheezing, eyes bright and a face exhausted with change. And as Manders checked Carol for unlikely, improbable life, the monster spoke.
"It's too late, Carol. You may wake yet, but you will wake in a box."
Then, as Manders removed the mirror, she saw the terrible thing float away, as if concerned with something else, here, in Harrow's. Then Manders closed the lid of her casket, and to Carol, it looked like a living wall of stone falling dead forever upon her. When he reached Main Street, the sky was bright with streaks of orange, reminding Moxie that it was, despite the sense of it being one unbroken nightmare, a new day. And yet the few early risers populating the dirt road looked upon him as they might their own death. His face and hands were covered in soot from the oil fire, and he wore the blood of smoke across the chest of his red shirt. Carol's body lay malleable as clothing in his arms. His hat was partly burned, and one onlooker, a cook, told his boss there was a maniac in the street who smelled something like decay. Moxie's eyes and teeth flashed through the dirt and ash, and had Sheriff Opal been on the street instead of at the Manders' funeral home, he would have stopped the outlaw on principle alone. He found the doctor immediately. In an empty storefront window with no sign declaring its purpose, Moxie saw the doctor who had first seen Carol some 2 decades past. He, too, looked to have been yanked from the grave. His muted blue suit was marred with dirt and stains from what looked and smelled like garbage. His thin brown hair appeared glued to his shriveled head. String, Moxie thought, like Silas's hair, the stringy coif of the dead. The doctor held open the door for Moxie to enter.
Doctor,
Moxie said, confused by the memories. Hadn't he seen this man by the fire?
She's fallen. Will you look at her?
The doctor gestured for Moxie to bring her to a cold steel table. His fingertips were black. Moxie set her down, gently. As he watched the doctor study her, he held one bloodied shirt sleeve over his mouth to block the smell of the man.
I want to help her this time, Moxie said. I'm ready.
The doctor shook his head no.
I don't want to turn my back on her this time.
The doctor shook his head no. Dust rose from the top of his head.
She's alive, doctor. I felt her heart beating myself.
When the doctor started to say no once again, Moxie grabbed him by his blue suit and thrust him against the wall. The doctor turned to dirt in his hands, thick earth sliding down the wall to the floor. Moxie, gripping only the stained suit now, heard the front door open and close. He turned to see the back of Carol leaving, going quickly past the storefront's cracked window. She was no longer on the table.
You see? She lives!
Moxie moved fast, following her out the door. Crazed, he looked up and down Main Street. He grabbed strangers by their wrists.
Have you seen her?
He shouted.
Have you seen her?
People backed away from him. One called out for Sheriff Opal. Moxie saw her standing in a second-story window of the Corey Hotel. His boots thundered across the plank boardwalk, and he entered the building, splintering the door as he did.
Can I assist you, sir?
A voice called from deep within the fog, from beyond the images of 4 fiery circles. A heart exploded, dirt piled tall as the pines, and eyes opening to find themselves in the dark, in a box, buried. Moxie climbed the hotel stairs fast and, gun drawn, kicked open the door to the second floor. Rot stood at the window at the end of the hall, facing him. The voice from the barber shop, from the cell in Albertsport, and from the other side of that fire, too, greeted Moxie. The voice that encouraged him long ago to leave Carol.
James Moxie, what a joy to have you here. Here, and not in the graveyard where you'd rather be.
Moxie understood. He fired. The form did not recoil. Moxie ground his teeth and fired again.
You won't stop me, he said. Not today.
Do you really think you would have chosen differently this time had I let the illusion persist?
Moxie fired again. Nothing.
You were at the barber shop, beneath a towel.
Yes.
You were behind the bars in Albertsport.
Yes.
You spoke from the other side of the fire.
Yes.
And you were there, in a tavern, long ago. You told me to leave her.
Yes.
Are you death?
No, I am rot.
I'll give you someone else to rot.
The eyes grew wider, trembling discs in a vague face.
You are going to kill the husband, no matter what deal we make.
Take the cripple, then. We're even.
The form laughed.
The cripple. I already got more from the cripple than you can imagine. No, Moxie,